This episode, we're talking numbers. 800 horsepower, $146 million deals, and 2,906 miles. The unofficial distance of the Cannonball Run. All that and more coming your way right now.
It's time to cruise the highways and byways of the auto industry's past, present, and future. Join us in exploring the vehicles, people, events, and places that have shaped the way we move. This is the Drive History Podcast.
What's up? Welcome to another episode of the Drive History Podcast. This is Brian Corey, joined as always by Jordan Stead.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening.
This episode, we're running down history for April 30th through May 6th. And we've got some pretty interesting tidbits coming your way. Jordan, I was just going to get us those delicious donuts from our local donut shop, which I'm not sure I'll say the name, just because we don't have a donut sponsor yet. But on my way back, I was behind a silver Cadillac SUV, like an old, like a 2015, I forget what they're called.
Yep.
But the license plate was Hootie, H-O-O-T-Y.
Okay.
And it just got me thinking about, like, how much a license plate says about somebody. And, like, I was just trying to figure out, like, who is this person based on Hootie? Like, were they in Hootie and the Blowfish? No, it's spelled different. Or do they just enjoy the sound of a nice honk? I don't know.
It's a great question. Yeah, a vanity plate just alone says so much about you. It doesn't even matter what the vanity plate says yet.
Right.
The fact that you went out and sought out and got a vanity plate is already step one.
You have disposable income. Maybe you're creative or you're kind of a jerk.
Yeah. I feel like that's it right there. You just figured out the recipe. That's totally it.
But yeah. It's so dependent on what the car is. Like what you can't put, you know, a funny license plate on like a sports car.
Yeah.
Because nobody will think it's funny.
Yes.
They'll just think you're an asshole.
Yes.
So
the weird ones that I've seen locally is there's a guy who owns two old Subarus, go figure, of course, in Bellingham, no surprise. Two old Subarus and the license
parts car.
Yeah, exactly. Probably a parts car. And his daily. But they are both always parked next to each other in the driveway, and one has a license plate that's something like A001 and the other one is A002. So you got vanity plates for the same car, two versions of it, like synchronized numbering.
I wonder if it maybe those two cars are they the same car,
like this, I think so, yeah.
Maybe that's like their serial numbers or their VIN numbers, and they're actually like
maybe
built right next to each other and he's just showing it off.
Yeah, it's just bizarre because the name or the amount of letters and numbers is something I've also never seen. It's like four. It's like four
weird
digits, right?
I know some people who put, like, if they're into radios, doing CB and stuff like that, they'll put their call sign on it, their call numbers on it.
Wow.
So that could be something like that. Yeah.
That's serious hot boy shit.
Yeah. Call me.
Oh, my God.
Speaking of hot boy.
Yeah, for real. Speaking about hot boys, very, very recently, the 2024 Shelby Super Snake was just unveiled, the new Mustang sort of trim edition package or whatever.
Oh, really?
You want to call
there's a special edition Mustang? Who would have thought?
Yeah, this is the only one. No, I'm just kidding. What's interesting about this is the Super Snake is Shelby America's first time working with the new S650 Mustang, which is the new body style, the new generation, and it's limited to 250 examples. Wow. And yeah, well, you know, scarcity protocol coming in hot here, right? Like, got to make sure you're going to sell those. I'm sure they're already all sold immediately.
For sure. Some prints in the UAE bought them all.
Exactly.
Already.
Yeah. The Sultan of Brunei or whatever. Yeah. Anyway, so it comes with the same 5-liter V8 that you can get on a GT Mustang that has 480 horsepower. But then, of course, there is a second version, which is an 830 horsepower version with a Whipple supercharger on it. And right before the podcast, I was talking to Brian about this. That we should bring this up. Hey, this is cool. And we really are wanting to talk less about this car, which is very badass, by the way, and I think is the coolest iteration of the new 650 Mustang that I've seen yet. It's way cooler than the Dark Horse, in my opinion.
Don't tell Steve Saline, though.
Yeah, that's right. And I think what we wanted to chat about briefly was just how 800 is the new 200 horsepower.
Everything's got so much power now.
So much power.
And whether it's an EV or a gas-powered car, like, cars are just fast. Yeah. And it's like, honestly, dangerous to some degree.
Yes.
Because, like you were saying, a lot of people have never driven a vehicle over 200 horsepower. And to get into something like this, you're going right through a wall.
It's just such a different experience, like, all around, right? The sound of it, the feel of it, the way it handles, just, and the immediacy of, like, even how far your foot goes down the pedal, right? So, for instance, if you have a really, if you have a normal person car, right, 150, maybe 200 horsepower.
You're flooring it to get on the freeway.
Yeah, literally. Like, you're wringing this thing's neck to even get up to 60 miles an hour.
Yeah.
And you could literally breathe on the accelerator pedal of this car and probably be going 100 miles an hour. Yeah. And I think the real test here is, I was just thinking about this. You never, everyone's been in that situation where they're parked in, right? You parallel park between two cars, and then you come back and somebody has like parked you in mega close.
So you tap the accelerator and you're already going 60 with it.
Yes.
You're just slammed into this car in front of you.
And whether you're driving an automatic or a manual, which of course this, the Super Snake has both options for, thank God.
Does it say what the starting price is?
It does. I know it's over 100K.
Yeah. There's probably only one price.
Yeah, probably. Unless you buy the non-supercharged version, which is just so weird to me.
You can't buy a non-supercharged Super Snake.
Yeah, yeah. It doesn't really make any sense. It's got to be super in some way. But imagine, like, you're parked in and you're in this car and, you know, you're like, you've got a half an inch between the front and back bumper between two, you know, Nissan Altimas or something, and you're like, I have to get out of here.
It doesn't matter, they're already dented.
This is true. You've got, you know, you've got your 27 point turn that you're about to do to get out of there. Just imagine having to, I mean, is it tapping, is it feathering, what are you even doing to move this car in a way to get you out of that situation without crashing into both of these cars?
Call a tow truck.
Yeah.
I love how we're talking about the slowest possible movements you could make in a car that goes 200 miles an hour.
Well, I think that's kind of part of the thing. If someone sees a car like this and they go, I'm going to be going so fast all the time, and they pull out of the dealer lot and they're immediately in gridlock traffic.
Well, let's be real. It's a Mustang.
Yeah.
So you're going to pull out of the dealer lot and walk straight into the insurance agency.
At least do it right. Yeah, exactly. Anyway, if you haven't seen pictures of this thing, it's super badass looking. It comes in an awesome red, and it's got a bunch of rad aero on it, and the wheels are cool. I mean, it looks badass. It's, like I was saying, it's my favorite iteration of the 650 so far, in my opinion. Love it.
Wham, bam.
Yeah, moving on.
Should we dive into a little history?
Let's do it.
All right. This week, we're covering April 30th through May 6th, and we're kicking off in 1925. So, following the death of John and Horace Dodge, the Dodge brothers, who you're probably familiar with from their representation in the latest Dodge Charger release video. You know, those two badasses carrying wrenches around. That was John and Horace. They both died of the flu epidemic in about 1920. And they were worth a fortune. They had only recently started Dodge Brothers. And it got left to their wives, and their wives negotiated the biggest sale of any car company or any company in the U.S. to that date.
Let's go.
Yeah. And they sold it to Dillon Reed and Company on April 30th, 1925 for $146 million, which is equivalent today to about $2.7
billion.
Mm. Plus, there was another $50 million designated to different charities.
Nice.
Like, good work, ladies.
Yeah, for real.
So it's just a really record-breaking number. And then Dillon Reed Company, which was just an investment bank at the time, sold it 2 years later to Chrysler, kind of birthing Mopar. Like, it brought together Chrysler and Dodge. A year later, they would introduce Plymouth. And so, man, this is some real origin story goodness.
Yeah. Wow, this is big day stuff right here.
Yeah. Also, man, I wish I just had 104. I don't need 2.7 billion. I need 146 million today.
Yeah. Oh, we could even reduce it back to pre-inflation.
It's fine.
Still cool with it.
Yeah. It's again, just one of those stories. It's kind of cool to just see how often car companies change hands.
Yeah.
It's constantly on the move.
I wonder how long it's going to be until Volkswagen owns every car company.
They probably already do, and they're just keeping it top secret.
Yeah. It's like how every alcoholic beverage is owned by like literally the same company.
Bush.
Yeah, and InBev or something like that. Oh, they're Brazil based. Yeah, and it's like, and you know, of course, they're all quote unquote competing against each other on the shelves and the in the corner store. You're like, oh man, should I support Corona or Soul? You know, it's like, well, it's all going to the same pocket.
I had a Victoria the other day, which is another Mexican lager, and it was actually really, really good.
Okay.
So if you see that one in the store, I don't know, it's probably owned by the same people, but it's delicious.
Support your local monopoly owning local company. Monopoly.
April 30th, 1978, the Mazda RX-7 makes its debut.
Yes, U.S. debut.
U.S. debut, yes. This car is amazing. It has a rotary engine. It was only precessed by the Mazda Cosmo in terms of mass production rotary engines. And then it stayed in production until 2002, and it was shortly replaced thereafter replaced by the RX-8. Why do you not think that there's more rotary engine cars?
I think it's just the price of engineering. It's just expensive. Yeah. And it's such a niche thing.
Yeah, sure. I know that they get kind of less fuel efficiency. They burn a lot of oil or can. So I'm sure that there's a few quirks that need to be worked out yet.
Yeah.
Good on Mazda for like keeping up with something that people love. They're not still doing something.
Well, so I think the answer is no, but I feel like every other year I read some article about how it's like Mazda, quote unquote, is considering a new rotary engine. I just read another article like this like a month ago.
Yeah, the rotary boys are like, yeah. rubbing their hands together, twisting their mustaches.
That's right. I'm sad because I've never ridden in an RX-7. I've never driven an RX-7, which would make sense because those two things are not mutually exclusive.
But I rode in an RX-7 straight into a garage door.
Nice.
I was probably 11. My uncle had one. My cousin and I were playing like cops and robbers in it, and it was a manual.
Perfect.
My cousin just bumped it into neutral, and it rolled down the driveway into the garage
door. Was it dig a total?
No, it was. I mean, it was going 3 miles an hour or something like that. Probably put a dent in the door, not in the car.
Hey, that would total a brand new car these days.
Yeah,
you know?
True. So,
yeah.
True.
Yeah, you've lost 400 sensors on the front of the car. It's immediately totaled. Wow. Yeah. You know what's interesting about this to me is the RX-7 feels like a car that ceased production in the 90s to me. 2002 feels way later than just the way that my brain has this...
Right.
In my own mental history.
In that last generation, they're really beautiful.
I
had to look it up too because
amazing.
Was surprised that it was that long of a production run.
Yeah. Yeah. Very in that same echelon of, Skyline, JDM, Holy Grail kind of stuff. Yeah. Very cool.
Well, speaking of Mazda, May 1st, 1984, Toyo Kogyo changes its name to Mazda officially. Toyo Kogyo was started in 1920 as a cork manufacturer.
Didn't know that.
Right. And then they expanded into the three-wheel truck game, which was apparently a big thing in Japan back in the day.
That's a sick game. I like that.
Releasing the Mazda Go in 1931.
It's a great name.
The Mazda Go.
Mazda Go.
Well, yeah. And Mazda comes from Ahura Mazda, which was like a god of harmony, intelligence, and wisdom. And so they used that name on all forthcoming vehicles, including their first passenger car, which came out in 1960, the R360.
Cool.
So,
where are all the three-wheel trucks today?
That's a great question. Probably like the Philippines. I
don't know. Well, like, why are there not more? I mean, maybe there's some sort of, there's got to be a rule now, right?
I remember something like several years ago about like three wheelers becoming illegal, but like three wheelers, like the ATV three wheeler. I mean, it seems like you could. Aren't those what are those trike cars everybody has now?
Polaris, Slingshot?
Polaris, Slingshot. Yep. Yeah. Are those three wheels or do they have two in the back?
They're three. There's two in the front, one in the back.
Right.
Yeah. And also, I love the name Mazda Go. Cute, fun. And this reminds me a lot of just K trucks.
It's basically a precursor to that.
Huh.
And it has a motorcycle front end. It's, I think they had like a cab on it that you could put on, but it's just an open bed. It's basically like a John Deere Gator kind
of situation. Oh, I immediately know what you're talking about now. Yes. Yes.
Pretty sweet.
Yeah.
May 2nd, 1918, General Motors acquires Chevrolet, sort of. It's kind of an interesting situation. William Durant, we've talked about him several times on this podcast so far. big figure in the pioneering days of the auto industry because he founded General Motors, but he got kicked out when he couldn't acquire Ford. And so he lost out on that deal, gets fired from the presidency for being reckless with how he was spending money, goes on to start Chevrolet in about 1913. I can't remember exactly the year, but about 1912, 1913 with Lewis Chevrolet, and then uses that car company, the success that it has, to acquire more and more General Motors stock until he has so much he can just take over the company again. And then nice. He becomes president of General Motors once again and has it acquire Chevrolet.
Hot boy moves right there. It's a big hot boy move.
He knew what he was doing. He ended up getting fired from the presidency again like 3 years later. And then he started his own car company, stayed in that. It shut down in the Great Depression, and he went on to open a line of movie theaters. So
I kind of feel like you're kind of like him a little bit, but like a nicer version. You're a scrappy dude, man. I could see you like doing some shit like this.
I like movies and cars. So.
There you go. See, I was not wrong. I'm going to interject here for a moment because we have a tiny little piece of very applicable reader mail that goes along with this point. And it's really just about Chevrolet. But on a previous episode, Brian and I were having a mild argument about truck versus SUV. If you're going to buy one for yourself, and it's going to be like your do-it-all vehicle. And I'm typically team SUV, even though I like trucks. And Brian is, I think, team truck.
When it comes to the same model, you know, the Tacoma versus the 4Runner or whatever, it's the same platform, same everything. Yeah, I'm probably gonna go with the truck version.
Yeah, perfect. Well, this is perfect because a little bit of reader mail, aka reader text message from our friend Carrie, who you guys always hear about and one day we'll hear on the podcast, but
he's not real.
He's not real. He's just part of our imagination. But anyway, he texted me and he said, you know, the thing you guys should chat about this is the Chevy Avalanche. And I looked it up, and of course, if you're not familiar with this, the Chevy Avalanche is a four-door, five or six-passenger pickup truck that was manufactured by GM. It was a hybrid between the Chevy Suburban SUV and the Chevy Silverado pickup truck, and it shared that same chassis with the Suburban, so big, gigantic SUV. And unlike the typical pickup truck where the bed is mounted separately from the cab on the frame, the bed of the Avalanche is like integrated into the cab.
It's unibody construction, essentially.
Right. And it was produced from 2001 to 2013 across two generations. I actually own a 2002 Tahoe, so I'm very familiar with what I believe they call the GMT 800 series of trucks. This is like all part of that same family.
Is that why all the clocks say GMT 800 when you set like go to set them?
Exactly, yeah. They made so many of these, they just changed our perception of time with this. Yeah. Anyway, this is what's most interesting about this is as I was reading through some information about the Avalanche, I don't know if this settles the debate or makes it more confusing, but the Avalanche was nominated for the North American SUV of the Year award and then was also Motor Trend Magazine's Truck of the Year for 2002.
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, like it's kind of the crossover was so seamless that people were just arbitrarily referring to it as a truck or an SUV, and it was winning awards for both at the time.
You use the term crossover, and to me, this is a true crossover. When you call a small SUV a crossover, it's like, it's just a car that's small. But this does multiple things. It's truly a crossover vehicle.
And to add on to this, the Avalanche was originally marketed as being able to, quote, change from being an SUV into a super SUV. So not, I think now the argument is SUV truck or super SUV.
Please tell me more about super SUVs.
This was made possible by a plastic cover and exclusive, quote, midgate called Convert a Cab System by GM, which could open and close. This midgate was a divider between the second row of seats that could be folded down with the seats to create a longer bed area or folded up to make a larger cab area.
Okay.
Yeah, and this was, of course, also seen on the Cadillac Escalade EXT, which, of course, if you are uncultured swine, Ludacris, I believe, made a music video where he put a hot tub in the back of an Escalade EXT truck. And if you don't know that, you clearly need to access the internet right now. Check that out.
Luda's coming to the fair up here.
I saw that. Yeah. And I'm happy for him. I'm happy for him. But I also know that once you end up on the country fair circuit as a musician,
a rap musician.
Yeah, things are trending a certain direction, I would imagine.
I want to go so bad.
I I might go.
I'm not going to be here.
I'll let you know.
Yeah, keep me posted.
Yeah.
But the, yeah, EXD, and you can find those around. I still want one.
Yeah, and you can basically...
But speaking of the bed, the bed pass-through, my Baja has that. So let's preface with this. The Avalanche came out in 2002, and then several other car companies kind of came out with a similar concept, SUV slash truck. The Super Baja followed in 2003. The Honda Ridgeline came out in, what did you say, 2004, I think, or five, maybe?
Something.
And Ford had the Explorer Sport Track.
Oh, actually, yeah.
Did that come out before or after? I can't remember. But anyway, this was an era of experimentation among the truck SUV world.
For sure. Yeah. And it's got that same beloved Vortec V8 in there. Mm-hmm. And it's in that engine's in like everything. They're just everywhere. And the parts for these vehicles are plentiful. Every work truck, van, Suburban, Tahoe had the same parts, and you could just continue to slap these parts on these things forever.
Right. Roll into the junkyard and you're good to go.
Literally. Yeah.
I dig it. Well, so what? Are you going to get an Avalanche now?
No, I'm already almost there with my Tahoe. So yeah. I'm set.
Just cut it off.
Exactly.
May 2nd, 1975, production of the BMW E21 platform begins, marking the launch of BMW's 3 Series executive compact car.
I'll make this quick, but I do have a little story.
Roll.
I'm as close to getting rid of my Forester as I've been yet. And this was largely because the other day on Facebook Marketplace, the place where our wallets go to die, someone in the local area said, I've got a 2001 BMW 3 Series 330 CI coupe.
There you go.
Manual with the sport package.
Wow.
Looking for trades for a family vehicle. And I sent him, hey, I've got this. What do I have? 04? 04 Forester base model with 130,000.
You better hurry. I'm going to send him an 06 Subaru
Baja. Well, it's for sale for $5,000.
Whoa.
And, I mean, it's got 148,000 miles on it. So this is old BMW stuff. Sure. But honestly, things pretty clean. It looks fully loaded. It's a coupe, of course. And this, at the time, was basically like, you could buy the M3, of course, but this was like the step below the M3, not the M car, but like the most fully loaded and fastest version of that 3 Series you could buy at the time. It's clean, man. It's two owners, all everything else freshened up, new tires. Take a guess.
Silver.
Yeah. it looks pretty clean. Honestly, I'm tempted. It's literally the opposite vehicle in which I need, but I'm like, there's something alluring about a trade that actually makes sense, or that you get a little bit extra.
And it's summertime, man. It's just about to be anyway. You need something to cruise.
Yeah, it's cool. I'm just too much of a wuss with this old used stuff.
Just do it. I don't know. I had that 98 BMW 323i convertible, 5-speed. It was so fun. You know, as soon as I got a quote-unquote real job out of college, I went and bought a BMW.
Yeah, of course
you did. It was a $4,000 BMW, but...
Hot boy moves right there.
It was my first, like, really fun car that I went out and bought. And, like, I definitely had cool cars before that, I guess.
Yeah.
But this was the one that made me realize it's fun to drive.
Yeah. I'll send it to you. I mean, this was, like... These are very hard to find, by the way. The 330s, the CI, which means coupe, a manual... and also with the sport package is like, I was doing a little bit of research and it's very hard to find. So I'll send it to you.
Did he respond?
He's like, okay, what's up? He like kept DMing me afterwards. So I think he has like a million kids and needs to get a car that actually can carry kids. So, anyway, yeah.
That's legit.
Who knows? TBD, maybe I'll buy this hunk of shit and I'll let you guys know on the next episode or something, but, or maybe Brian will steal it out from under me. We'll see what happens.
The drama continues.
Yes.
This week on the Drive History Podcast, Brian steals Jordan's car. If you didn't know, this is a true crime podcast.
It is. Or it's about to be.
Yeah. Live. May 3rd, 1984, the song Pink Cadillac by Bruce Springsteen is released. I was going to read you some of the lyrics, and I want you to tell me if this is a song about cars or something else.
Okay. Here we go. We're going to get the explicit tag on this episode. I just know it.
They say Eve tempted Adam with an apple, but man, I ain't going for that. I know it was her pink Cadillac. Crushed velvet seats riding in the back.
Okay.
But then it goes on to say, pardon the pause while I scroll through the lyrics. But my love is bigger than a Honda. Yeah, it's bigger than a Subaru. Hey man, there's only one thing and one car that will do. So it's kind of a toss-up. I think we're talking about a few different things here.
It's very possible, Brian. Very possible we could be talking about multiple things.
Who would have ever thought that a song could be so multi-characteristic?
It's amazing also how song lyrics just sound so dumb, no matter what song it is, when you just read it out.
Well, you're lucky I didn't translate it. Do you have driving music? What do you listen to when you're out cruising?
That's a good question for me, because I'm not sure I have the answer. If it's a fun car, I'm music off 100%.
Cool.
I don't think I ever turned any music on in my Miata or my Abarth ever. Just the sound of it was so much fun. Now that I have a not fun car, I'm just like,
you're listening to NPR.
yeah. I'm a big metal head. I like a lot of metal, so I listen to a lot of metal, but I listen to everything. So I'm just kind of like shuffling around through liked songs and Discover Weekly on Spotify. I'm not really like, I don't have like a specific thing, I guess.
I'm the same way. I mean, I think it's car dependent on what I'm listening to. Mm-hmm. Honestly, if I get in the car and I'm driving an hour down the freeway, I'll probably just turn on like whatever the classic rock radio station is.
Yeah.
Like having a radio is so much more convenient than plugging in my phone, finding it, like scrolling through everything. But yeah, good music can make or break a ride, I feel like, sometimes.
Totally.
And I agree with you. Not listening to music is also a good option.
Yeah. With
the right cars.
With the right exhaust, you don't need music where you're going. But go figure, I'm starting to listen to more podcasts as well, which...
Look at that.
I got to admit, it is pretty great on a long drive.
Yeah.
It's true. Ideal.
Keeps you awake.
Yes, 100%.
May 4th, 2006, Aston Martin debuts the DBS, yes, which would soon become James Bond's new ride. And he, of course, has had a long history with Aston Martin. I have never had an interaction with an Aston Martin, so I can't really speak to this too much, but they're beautiful.
They are. They always have been beautiful.
I feel like they're fairly affordable, like on the used car market for what they are.
Probably for a good reason, but give me your hot take. Would Aston Martin be even 1/10 of what it is now without James Bond?
Oh, wow. No, I don't think so.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah. Are you familiar with the James Bond Aston Martin that got stolen from an airport in Florida? Like, I think it was like the early 2000s or something, or late 90s.
It was like parked in the airport?
Like somebody had it in their collection. It was like a 1960s Aston Martin that was in Goldfinger or something like that.
Yeah.
And it was like one of the movie cars. Literally somebody stole it, drove it onto an airplane at the airport, and it was never seen again.
That's the most James Bond shit I've ever heard in my life. Drove it onto an airplane?
Yeah, and like legit stole it. Like flew it out of there.
That's a real heist right there.
Totally,
100%. That's real heist stuff.
Yeah. There's a guy who's like a Nazi art hunter. Like he tries to recover art from World War II that like the Nazis raided and stole and all that kind of stuff. And he says he knows where it is, but he can't prove it because it's in the Middle East somewhere. And he doesn't want to get into too much trouble.
Can we also talk about how Nazi art hunter is probably the coolest LinkedIn title you could ever have?
What do you do? Nazi art hunter.
Enough said, really.
Yeah, for real. May 5th, 1914, Irwin Baker begins his first cross-country motorcycle run. His speed in doing so would earn him the name Irwin Cannonball Baker, after a journalist wrote that he's faster than a cannonball train. So this led to the term the Cannonball Run, which we all know today as kind of an unsanctioned cross-country
race.
But it's all of a sudden just against the clock.
It is.
There's the great Cannonball Run movie with Burt Reynolds, I think, when everybody's trying to do it, which is hilarious and wonderful. But these days, it's kind of just, yeah, race against the clock. And
guerrilla style.
Totally. So in that original run that Baker did, he left San Diego on a motorcycle, by the way, an Indian motorcycle, ended up in New York 11 days later, which broke the record that had stood then by 9 days. So pretty quick, pretty quick.
Can you imagine what his ass felt like?
Right. I mean, there was barely roads at this point.
Oh, my God.
Also, today, the record stands at 25 hours and 39 minutes, which is insane. And that, so the, it's kind of understood that the race goes from, there's a hotel or a parking garage in New York, the Red Ball parking garage, to the Portofino Hotel in Redondo Beach outside of Los Angeles. And that's sort of the given starting and end points for this, for people trying to break the record. It's 2,906 miles. So the guys that did it, that set the current record, it was October 2021. They'd previously set the record at something like 29 hours or 27 hours. Somebody else broke that and they're like, oh no, we got to get it back. And I believe that they had done it previously in a Mercedes, that, you know, they outfit mm-hmm. it with all the gear to do it. And this time they picked a 2015 Audi S6.
Mm-hmm.
They put in a 45 gallon fuel cell. But the best part is that they disguised it to look like a Ford Taurus police interceptor.
Yes. So, yes.
Man.
If you haven't seen this, it's fully documented on YouTube.
Yeah, it's wild.
It's amazing. The guys who did it show, give you the whole runaround of the car and how they modified it and how they made it look like a Taurus. It's amazing. It's really cool.
That's insane, though. It averages 113 miles per hour from New York to LA.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's like the speed that I wish I was traveling at most of the time when I have to get somewhere. Like that's what makes me so mad about driving slowly, especially on the freeway, is you just think about how if you could just double the speed limit, we can get there twice as fast.
Yeah, until twice as many people crash their cars because they don't know what they're doing.
I know, but think about Autobahn. Like the traffic right. accidents are so low because you actually have to be paying attention.
No, you are fully correct about that.
Yeah.
We're just too dumb here.
this is true. What was I going to say about this? Oh, you know what this reminded me of is in the early 2000s, right around Fast and the Furious time, beginning of the series, of course, there were these DVD series about the Gumball Rally.
Oh, yeah.
And this was, I don't know the exact specifics, but as a younger man, this was like the coolest, most underground car sports car thing ever. It was basically like similar to the Cannonball Run where people were like racing across country or whatever, but they would do it as a group in a bunch of epic cars.
Yeah.
Like really loud, crazy, fun Ferraris, Lamborghinis, tuned like stuff.
Generally European thing, right?
I think so. Yeah. I don't, you know, I probably shouldn't even speak on it right now, but basically the point I'm trying to make here is just like how skateboarding had all those cool start on like DVDs where it was always like the cool underground new DVD just dropped.
You waited for it.
Yeah, you're waiting for it. Like Gumball had the same thing going on back then. Cool. And I had a couple of them as a kid and they were awesome. So check those out if you can find them on YouTube or something. It was like really epic footage.
I think you can still rent them at Blockbuster.
There you go. Yeah, there you go.
Man. Last but not least, May 6th, 1928. Chrysler introduced the DeSoto line of cars, which was supposed to slot in. They had just created Dodge, and it was supposed to go, you know, in their lineup. Chrysler at the top, DeSoto right under it, Dodge, and then Plymouth. Those three brands kind of bounced. Well, Plymouth always remained at the bottom, but Dodge and DeSoto would always bounce back and forth in the pricing lineup because they couldn't really figure it out. It was almost too many cars, too many brands within their structure. But what I thought was most interesting about this is that DeSoto went out of production in 1960, along with a lot of other car companies in the 1950s, Edsel, Hudson, they were merging, they were just going out of business. And I feel like we might get to a point here pretty quick, and like currently, that we see kind of a die-off of some of these brands that have come up in the past 10 years or so, especially in the EV world. And it's not something that we've really experienced in our lifetimes because it's always just been the same, you know, 12 automakers.
Yep. I'm going to go ahead and say that Fisker is going to be the first one to go in this new area.
Sorry, Fisker.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, Lucid. What's the other one? There's a bunch.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. It'll be interesting to see what happens. And I mean, even like with Tesla, and they just had the gas pedal slip up with the Cybertruck. Like, that's gonna take a toll on them for a while. So we'll see what happens. And obviously, people are just still unsure about the whole EV thing in general.
Yeah, there's just a lot of like dropping demand, I guess, as of the recording of this podcast. There's kind of a lot of I think there's just never been enough education about them as well. I don't think people know what they're getting into.
Totally.
And, you know, even from things like, you know, the how batteries in EVs are so much less efficient in cold weather. Like, I think people buy their first electric car, don't even think about that. And then suddenly their 250-mile range car has 190 straight out of the gate.
Right, you know,
it's like, it doesn't seem like a big deal until it's suddenly a really big deal.
Right, yeah, 100%. I feel like the infrastructure is getting there.
Yeah.
In terms of being able to like drive cars long distances too, but also you gotta sit, wait. It's not just sitting, getting to a gas station and filling up and being on your way.
Yep. So to conclude here today, I think what we're trying to do is we're trying to get some sort of electric car manufacturer to, by the way, this idea is copyrighted. No one take this idea. I want to get a demo car from an electric car manufacturer that has the balls to do it. And then let us cannonball run that bitch across the U.S. to test the infrastructure.
Let's go.
Let's go.
23 hours for hitting it.
Not with those charging times. But let's see here. Take us away on some reader mail. What do we got today?
Yeah. Well, we have a fan. And he likes to stay in touch with us. So we are getting reacquainted with our buddy Chris. And if you remember an episode or two ago, we were talking about, or you were talking about, are wagons cool? And he had a response to that. Hey guys, yes, wagons are definitely cool. Great for kids, dogs, homeowners, and always looking better than the non-wagon versions of the same vehicle. We've owned three, Volvo 740, Volvo 940, and BMW 328xi, which I used while I was doing mobile tech work. Which is awesome. Like, I would love it if my mechanic showed up in a BMW wagon.
Yeah, you know, he knows how to work on stuff, at least.
Yeah, for sure. I drive a 2006 BMW M235i, so totally biased. Can't wait for the next show. Thank you, Chris. I'm just going to have to agree with him. And I know that we'll get into this on one of these breakout episodes, but wagons are cool. I don't care if I'm being fed that information from automotive journalists.
Yeah.
I can look at a car and be like, oof, look at that roof line.
Yes.
Sick.
Now you can think about this on your own. Like, you've decided this by yourself. What I meant was more of people who haven't made this decision, right? Who have been reading car media for X amount of years,
right?
Who have never even considered a wagon, don't even necessarily like them in the first place, but they just say wagons are cool because X magazine said it was cool enough times to where you believe it.
That's
what I mean. But Chris, you are correct. These are the reasons why wagons are actually cool.
Wagon propaganda.
That's right.
Exactly. We're living in a regime.
That's right. We are also, and we're a part of it, to be totally honest.
Yeah.
We are a part of it considering we both love and own. Also, yes, totally agree with you, Chris. And also your taste in cars is excellent. I have been very close to getting a 328xi, and actually a 2016 M235i was the closest I ever came to actually buying a BMW in my life. So as opposed to what I was talking about earlier in the episode, I'm still not that close to that one, but the 235i was like very much something I was considering buying for a couple of years and ended up in a BRZ at the time. But those are awesome cars, highly underrated, very cool, fun options, manual, auto, xDrive, no xDrive. You have great taste, sir. Thank you for listening.
Good work. And with that, we're kind of wrapping it up. I just want to make sure everybody remembers to hit that big subscribe button.
Do it.
Please share.
Do it.
Please rate.
Do it.
Please leave us a review. And please send us some reader questions, comments, concerns at contact@carsandcopymedia.com.
Yes. And also, we're expanding, because this is episode 12, right?
Yeah.
As we continue to push forward, we're always going to be doing a similar episode layout is this, but we do want to start focusing on breakout episodes, and those episodes will basically just discuss one topic, right? So our wagon's actually cool. We'd spend the time in that whole episode just talking about that. So you have a topic or something that would make for a great breakout episode that you'd love to hear us, you know, talk shit about, love on, whatever, please shoot us a note on Instant Messenger. Why did I say that? Instant Messenger.
DM us.
We don't do that. Don't Instant Message us. Send us an email. Send it to us on social media.
Jordan's cell phone number is...
my AIM screen name is... Oh, my God. Get us off this podcast today.
Oh, my gosh. Thank you for listening. Till next time, drive history every day.
Bye.